Welcome to The Jewish Diasporist, a podcast exploring the political, social, and cultural implications of life in diaspora. We are two of your hosts, Ben Yanowitz
and Jordan Yanowitz. For this episode, we interviewed Hadar Cohen, an Arab-Jewish scholar, mystic, and artist whose work focuses on the intersection of spirituality, social justice, and community building.
This is a spiritual successor to episode 30, in which Zach interviewed Avi Schleim and explored Arab-Jewish history. With Hadar, we discussed the complexities and tensions within modern Arab-Jewish life and identity.
By tying together personal, spiritual, and historical perspectives, we delved into the richness of Palestinian Jewish identity, focusing on its close ties to the land and its broader relationships to Arab and Mizrahi identities.
As always, we'd like to thank all of our donors, supporters, and audience. If you like what we are doing here, please rate our show on your podcast platform of choice, follow us on Instagram at The Jewish Diasporist Pod, and consider becoming a donor on Patreon. Most importantly, please share our content with your communities. Every donation, like, follow, and share, especially in person, helps us build the world we want to live in.
Links to all of this and Hadar's generous teachings and content can be found in the description below.
Without further ado, we hope you enjoy the conversation.
We are beautiful people, though our hearts are broken. We sing for justice and wholeness.
Welcome, Hadar. It's really wonderful sitting down with you. I know that personally, I've been a big fan of your podcast, your work, and it's really wonderful to really sit down and get a chance to talk. So let's just start with a little introduction. Who are you and what brings you to your vocation, your work?
Yeah, well, thank you so much for having me. So my name is Hadar. I was born in Jerusalem and when I was 10, moved to the U.S. and actually currently working on a book about this. But I think so much of my life has been around having this in-between identity, whether that's, you know, literally moving when I was 10 and my first language was Hebrew and then learning English, or right, the Arab-Jewish identity that I talk about a lot as well as being kind of this mix that is quite unusual in our political reality today, at least to claim that. And yeah, I think that it's quite interesting because a lot of my work is around the intersection of spiritual work with political work. And I think that one of those things that I find in common around my path and my vocation is that both actually deal with this in-between space. You know, I teach a lot about mysticism and spirituality, and a lot of that requires, right, this non-dual approach that is getting beyond the binary, getting beyond seeing reality through these particular kind of two-sided lenses and understanding what's in between and opening up that space. And yeah, with Arab-Jewish identity, it's also, right, that power of doing that politically of like, well, what happens in the in-between identity and when we open up that space?
That in-between space is really what I feel like Ben and I and Zach as well and others see as kind of the heart of diasporism, if we're going to turn it into an ism, of this going out and coming back and this constant process, this struggling. One thing that really stands out in your work to me is your focus on healing. Can you tell us a little bit about how your Judaism fits into that healing work?
Yeah, you know, a lot of it really comes from Kabbalistic teachings, which, you know, there's many different lineages and strands of Kabbalah, but one of them that I really resonate with is that in some ways the world was created for what is called Tikkun Olam, which means the healing of the world. Now, of course, there's so many Jewish organizations that take that to mean so many different things, but for me, and as I understand the Kabbalistic teaching of it, is around how part of creation was actually so much imperfection and so much suffering. Sometimes there's the analogy with the process of birth or labor, right? Like no one gives birth to a child because of the pain that they'll endure, but they know that the pain will be part of that, right? There's no question, there's no doubt that pain will be part of this process of creation. But there's something about creation or birth or, you know, bringing new life that's worth it. And I think that that's kind of the similar teaching of how God created this world, is that suffering and pain wasn't the purpose of it, but it was almost inevitable in creation. And the creation itself was worth that pain and suffering. And I think that for me, seeing reality through that view kind of gives a certain level of human responsibility to our life here. Whereas that, you know, understanding that through this creation process, through us being alive, right, there's so much beauty in that. And there's also almost like this byproduct of pain and suffering that it's our responsibility to look at and to heal and to create a better world, right? To leave this world better than when we first came in. The spiritual path, you know, has to in some ways be about that. Because if it's not, it's a very selfish path, then it doesn't make sense as a spiritual path anymore. You know, the spiritual path has to lead in some way to service, to healing, to justice, to transforming the world to be a kinder, more loving place.
Mm-hmm. I mean, that really resonates with me. And I think probably most of people that would be listening to our podcast, because ultimately, I mean, I think it's the same way that I've always thought about it with like politics in general. Like if you're pushing a certain perspective, way of understanding, what's the point if it's not actively making the world a better place? If it's just pushing things off into the future or into the realm that we can't know about or whatever that might be understood as, it doesn't really serve humanity. It doesn't serve our planet. And I do think it's really important to recognize that we as humans can be understood as partners in the process of creation, people that we create our own experiences, we create the systems and institutions we live within, and recognizing that culture is something that's actively produced every single day through the course of our lives, I think is really important to understanding both like spirituality, but also just sociology and history and how we got to the point we're in. I was wondering if you could say a little bit about the different cultures and different places that your ancestors came from, mm-hmm. and like perhaps the tensions between some of their longer term perspectives and the narratives that might be told about them.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. So my family is a blend of various Middle Eastern lineages. Both my parents were also born in Jerusalem, and my dad's parents were also actually both born in Jerusalem. And from my grandma's lineage, we've been there for the 10th generation. So kind of deep Jerusalem roots. And then my grandfather his mother was from Aleppo, from Syria, and kind of that fusion of Aleppo, Jerusalem, especially within Jewish mysticism, you know, those cities are not that far from each other and share a lot in terms of their culture and perspective. And yeah, we're also kind of these, you know, big cities with a lot of culture, a lot of music, a lot of art. So that's kind of the lineage of my dad. And from my mom's side, she's Kurdish. So she was born in Jerusalem, but her parents were both born in a small Kurdish village called Sakiz, which is in northern Iran. And yeah, they moved to Jerusalem in the 50s. So yeah, kind of like this fusion of like Levant, Syria, Palestine area, and then kind of more Iran. And yeah, there's so much to say about the different culture. I mean, one is that, you know, like my dad's lineage was very much like a city lineage of a lot of culture, a lot of learning, a lot of multiculturalism, a lot of education about different religions, different places. Yeah, my grandparents were both super well-educated and yeah, very creative people. My grandfather was a spiritual prayer leader and my grandmother was an artist and businesswoman. And then from my mom's side, my Kurdish side, yeah, they were in, you know, a very like oral tradition village. So they didn't really read or write and the lifestyle was just super different. So yeah, and I think it's interesting to just also find beauty in both of those lineages, you know, of like both kind of like the like city multicultural lifestyle and also the more smaller kind of village land-based tradition. So yeah, which I do see myself kind of oscillating between as well. But in general, I think, you know, both of those sides kind of came from what you could say like a Middle Eastern Jewish lens which of course there's, again, it's so multifaceted. There's so many ways of understanding or thinking about it. But for me, the way that I relate to it, and, you know, part of kind of claiming Arab Jewish lineage is also being in relationship to that level of consciousness that those lineages hold, which is really about being able to, like, I really see it like in my dad's lineage around this intersection of science and spirituality. Like, my grandfather was like a prayer leader and my dad's like a quantum physicist. And that's something I say a lot, but, like, you know, that science and spirituality are just like one and the same. And that's definitely something that I see in a lot of kind of this Jewish mystical lineage that I really love, that it's not just about having these like woohoo new age spiritual experiences, but it's, spirituality is actually also a deep science. It's about really understanding the nature of the world and studying it. And I think that that's something that you actually see all over the region. I think that it's not a coincidence that so much deep spiritual teachings come from those lands, because there's also a lot of wisdom in the people of the land, right? And the ways of thinking and the ways of being that I think globally we have kind of lost, right? Because there's been so much dehumanization and racism around the people of that region.
Kind of turn back towards Tikkun. We often focus on Tikkun Olam, but one thing that in my kind of journey towards Kabbalah, I've learned is that Tikkun begins in the person. And, you know, this non-dual kind of approach that you described, recognizing that the human body and the universe are co-constituting one another, and that in community, there is this generative process of learning and kind of uncovering and interbeing that helps us ground ourselves. And with the colonialism and racism that you described, we've separated ourselves from the world a lot. And to kind of turn towards that multicultural community that you were describing, how does your Judaism emerge from that or respond to that? Or where do you go from that? Tell us maybe a little bit about your own personal experience of growth.
You know, I've just been reflecting on it actually this week and kind of the time of high holidays and when, as we're recording this podcast, but something my grandfather would say a lot in one of his kind of deeper teachings was that, and something that I really feel like I inherited on a almost like somatic level, is that part of being like a practicing Jew or a devout Jew or religious Jew is holding this love for humanity, right? Because if you love God, then you have to also love God's creation, which is many things, but one of those things is humans. And I think a lot of the times there's this way that we get so angry or mistrustful at other people and we want to change them or we want to fix it them or whatever it is, whether it's in our personal relationships or in our collective kind of political work. And I think when we're missing that element of just pure love for humanity, we get really sidetracked around what we're actually doing. And I think that one of the core kind of Jewish teachings that have really informed me is around this really sacred love for humanity. I mean, we're about to kind of enter the Rosh Hashanah, the Jewish New Year, and that is all about creation of the world, not just about the Jewish particular story. You know, we have that for Passover. Passover is the holiday that is just about, you know, the particulars of Jewish tradition, but Rosh Hashanah is about like the creation of the entire world and the way that we're all kind of interconnected. And that's such a core part of our lineage as well. And I oftentimes get frustrated with what has become of so much of our Jewish community, that there's so much isolation and segregation and separation from the rest of humanity, and almost a, like, not seeing ourselves reflected in others. And that to me is a big issue, because I think that understanding myself as a Jewish woman, like, I also have to understand myself as a human being, right? Those things are connected. I feel that we have often lost our way around that. It's just first seeing the humanness, you know, before we see the Jewishness, not to negate the Jewishness, but to give it a deeper anchor into a wider human family, which, you know, I think that there's so much to say about Zionism or even the way that sometimes Jewish community responds to anti-Semitism. But yeah, I think that this like anchoring and love in general, but specifically about love of humans, like Ahavat HaBriyot, right? It's called like the love of the creatures of this planet. And it's a practice. It's not like, you know, you just wake up and you're like, I'm filled with love. But it's a practice to say like, okay, there's tension here. There's conflict here. There's all sorts of things here. but how can I find that deeper thread that roots me in, like, why I'm here and why we're interconnected in the first place?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think when we talk about the sort of labels that we identify ourselves with, whether it be like gender labels or like ethno-religious or whatever types of labels we're using to describe ourselves, people often do forget that we're human first and foremost. Like, we are a species that has a specific relationship to this earth that is inherently contradictory. I mean, in our Judaism and in the Torah, you have two, you have Exodus 1 and 2, and you have two creation stories that are extremely contradictory. The first one saying that it's our role, I might mix up which one's which, but one of them saying it's our role to till and tend the earth, to take care of the earth, and the other one that it's our role to master and dominate the earth. And these are inherently contradictory. And I do think when we think about the course in which Judaism and Jewish history has gone over the last 150 years or so, we often forget that, like, it's inherently contradictory. There's not going to be one grand narrative that says, this is the way Jewish history has gone, this is what it means to be Jewish. It's always been a struggle. And I believe we're honestly at, like, a really critical juncture within that struggle, whether it means that we as Jews need to be isolating ourselves from the rest of the world, or whether we gather in solidarity, recognizing that all of our struggles are bound together if we want to live in a world of justice and peace and prosperity and true freedom. And when we do look at, like, the history and even, like, your own particular history, I mean, I believe you have ancestry that comes out of, I mean, you said Aleppo and you said, of course, Jerusalem, but also Aleppo itself had a deep variety, a deep diversity of Jews within it. Could you say a little bit about how these different strands within your lineage have related to each other and how these different ways you might identify yourself relate to one another, as you said, kind of rooted in that common humanity?
Well, first, just to respond to some of what you said, which I really resonate with, is one way I think about identity is, like, in Judaism, we have this concept called levush, which means, like, the clothing. You know, it's a mystical concept of thinking about, like, okay, what is the levush and what's the essence? Like, what's the clothing and what's the essence? Now, it's not to say that, right, the levush or the garments or the clothing that we wear is not important. There's actually so much beauty. And there's actually so much even in the Torah itself, you know, even thinking about the priestly lineage and how they would prepare. So much about wearing different garments and different things like that, but it's not necessarily the essence of who we are. And I think this is where we get confused a lot of the times, right? Because if we identify with the clothes I wear as opposed to, like, who I actually am, a lot can get distorted in my understanding of myself. But if I understand that identity is in some ways like a certain thing, that the way that I am perceived or perceive the world, right, then it becomes, sometimes it can become playful, but it can also just be a lens of how I see or how I relate. And I think that's part of how I've come to do the work that I do, is to see, like, you know, part of creation is that we're each, for whatever reason, born into whatever family we're born into, right? We don't know. We just, this is a family, this is my identity. And we can choose to say, you know, I'm going to look at that. I'm going to look at that as the portal of what there is for me to know and learn about myself and about the world. Or I could also reject that and then try other identities on, but usually that becomes quite strange. But I think, like, thinking of identity as that kind of path. And for me, that distinction feels important, because sometimes, especially when I do Arab Jewish work, you know, there's sometimes these moments where it sometimes feels even like self-orientalizing, where you're just like asserting yourself in the identity and then that's it. But really, like, part of that identity is actually almost having this microscope that I can look at some other things that I actually want to look at, which is, as you were saying, particularly, I mean, Aleppo is, like, for me, one of the most beautiful cities that ever were. And, you know, sadly, it's, like, mostly destroyed these days. But, you know, one of the things that's so powerful about Aleppo is specifically after the expulsion of Jews from Andalusia, from Spain and Portugal, you know, Jews went into so many different places. But one of the places they went to was Syria. I mean, all over the Ottoman Empire in particular. But to Aleppo, one of the most beautiful things that happened there is that there was a lot of fusion between kind of the local Arab indigenous Syrian population that was there and the Andalusian influence. And you could see that in the music style, you could see that in the food style, where a lot of Syrian food is like Andalusian food and all this kind of mixing. But it's something that I really love about this culture of hospitality and openness and kind of being unafraid of the immigrant, because they actually come and share more culture with us and we can mix and we can create a new culture together. And I think that people who are scared of other cultures kind of coming in and informing theirs are perhaps not fully rooted in their own, right? Because when you're fully rooted in your own culture, there's just more beauty when you're mixing with another culture. But if you're not rooted in your own culture and another culture comes, you might feel threatened, right? And then you might try to dominate and all of these kind of dynamics that happen, especially with colonialism. So yeah, I think that there's something that's really beautiful that I've tried to emulate, you know, a lot throughout my work. You know, my work is public, but it's also sometimes very personal and communal in terms of even celebrating Jewish holidays, where it's just like, okay, if I'm celebrating Hanukkah, like, how can I make sure people of other cultures, people of other faith feel invited and welcome? And what does that look like to actually have that mixing space again? And it's been so beautiful over the years. I mean, just even hosting Shabbats, like so many of my Shabbats these days include Palestinians, because there's something that feels missing almost without having Palestinians in a Jewish space, because it feels like our faiths are so bound up together. So what does it look like to open ourselves into those ways of relating to others, of this welcoming, you know, this radical hospitality, which, you know, if you could trace it all the way back to Abraham and Sarah, which that was their tradition as well.
That's really profoundly beautiful. I feel like welcoming the stranger and loving your neighbor are at the heart of what it means to be Jewish. And what you were saying about levush, and I guess lev would be the heart versus the clothing, and recognizing that identity isn't something that's, you know, just skin deep, just superficial, but it's something that goes straight into the heart of who we are. And for me, I feel like there's the same tension between Israel as this, you know, spiritual struggle of this wrestling with God versus Israel as like an identity label where it's kind of devoid of the spiritual meaning. And when we focus on it instead as that spiritual process, as this wrestling with God, then we're more open to like realizing that my identity is as a human being who is trying to love their neighbors. And it's not something that, you know, the neighbor is a threat to my own identity. And like what you were just saying about Abraham and Sarah, that's what it means to be, you know, at home in relation to our neighbors and to be secure in our own self to the point that we can invite people in and have those meaningful dialogues. And it's truly beautiful.
Yeah. And I'll just add that, like, on a psychological level, right, like the fear of the other is always rooted in a fear of the self, right? Because it's always projection. So when we're scared of the other, it's actually they're representing parts of us that we haven't fully integrated or processed. So part of us pushing them away is actually pushing parts of us away. And, you know, I think that part of that hospitality lens is also a certain level of openness to the parts in ourselves, you know, this kind of mirror work.
I really appreciate that. It actually really reminds me of the way that Daniel Kahn defines what is a Jew in his song, The Jew and You, where he describes saying to be a Jew is to identify with the inner other, to think of yourself in terms of the ger, in terms of being someone that isn't an insider, is someone that's an outsider. And what you said before that really resonated with me as well, because I've always thought like to be a diasporous Jew is to say that I'm comfortable enough in my identity to not feel the need to be in a majority, to not need an ethno state to support and enable my identity. I feel like my identity is stable and proud and isn't rooted in the need to dominate another in order to feel like I can have a sense of safety. And another core part of how I've understood diasporism, I mean, there's no dictionary definition of this word at this point, but a core element of diasporism that I've identified for over a year and a half at this point is to say that to be a diasporist is to really strongly believe in the power of intercultural exchange and the importance of blending and learning from each other in a way that is transformational, in a way that is rooted in Buber's I-Thou relationship, one that is built on love and built on really truly seeing the other and being open to learning and growing through that relationship. And too often, like, our modern epistemologies see like Arab and Jew as things that are fundamentally different, fundamentally other to each other. But then you and your work and many other people doing this similar work really strongly identify with this idea of an Arab Jew, of an Arab Judaism. And I was wondering how you understand the relationship between your identity as an Arab and a Jew, and the importance of marrying these two relationships to you, as well as, of course, like the difficulties in like the current moment we live in.
Yeah. So, you know, growing up in Jerusalem and Israeli society, I mean, there was and there still is, and probably even more so these days, just extreme racism towards Arabs. Arabs as people, Arabs for how they think, how they dress, how they are, like all of these things. And, you know, especially in the 90s when I was growing up, there's a bit more kind of exotification around like Arabic as a language or, you know, certain music or whatever. But back then it was very like, you know, and this is something that happened to a lot of Arab Jews, or Mizrahim, as sometimes is another word for them, where, you know, a lot of us either came from Arabic speaking homes, or at very least had Arabic words and songs, definitely music. But that was something that we were taught to be ashamed of, that, you know, if that's kind of the type of family you came from, you would deny it and you pretend that is not true, that you don't do it, you know, and that's definitely how I grew up. I grew up with just so much shame around this identity. And, you know, I remember even when we moved to the US, we moved to New Jersey, which into a very Ashkenazi space. And when people would ask me about my identity, I actually would lie as like a 12-year-old and say that I was Ashkenazi because I didn't want to be seen for that lineage. And like, yeah, working through those like levels of shame and almost like invisibilization, or like trying to be different, or trying to like right fit into like the Western educated intellectual Jewish world or whatever, was quite painful. And I guess it was a series of moments that happened over time, but there was this shift that happened that was like, wait a minute, why do I feel this in my body around myself? And yeah, started seeing more of like the beauty of the richness of the culture, and started to reject the ways in which, you know, I was constantly kind of experiencing that racism, and actually seeing it more as a power of like, oh, there's something that I actually hold that's powerful, that's threatening. And what does it look like to actually root in that more? And then it kind of became, you know, a decade-long journey of like reclaiming my lineage and seeing what was destroyed and why. And I think that this choice of also identifying as an Arab Jew didn't just come from this personal one of like investigating my lineage, and also just being curious about like, well, why wasn't I taught about my lineage? Why is it always about the Holocaust, or, you know, the Ashkenazi lineage and the Ashkenazi food and all the Ashkenazi traditions? Like, where is my Jewish lineage in it? So I think that was part of it. But then the other part of it was like solidarity with Palestinians. I mean, as I was kind of going through this Arab Jewish identification crisis, Palestinians were so supportive. Like, it was always almost like mind-boggling, because, you know, I was taught living under Israeli society that like Jewish unity and, you know, we're all in this together, and Palestinians and Arabs are the enemy that we must fight and destroy, and kind of that whole master narrative. But in actuality, what was true for me in my personal experience is that for the most part, Ashkenazim were completely disinterested in my lineage, and Palestinians were so supportive of me asking these questions, of me looking at my roots, of wanting to learn more, wanting to understand more what happened to the Jews of Jerusalem, to the Jews of Aleppo. Like, it wasn't just this interest or fascination that was coming from this like, oh, I want to be above you, but it was like, wow, I truly actually care about what happened to you. and we don't have access to those learnings. And that for me was such a big motivator for me. I mean, it was so essential for me, especially when in my early 20s. And yeah, I think that it was like claiming this Arab side of me was also this desire to say, you know what, Arab is actually beautiful. There's nothing wrong with being Arab. There's nothing dirty or disgusting or barbaric or like actually quite the opposite. It's a really, really powerful identity. It's filled with so much history and richness and so much love and care. You know, I think it's always so, this is a side note, but like sometimes when I look at the media, whether it's Israeli media or Western media, it's so mind-boggling to me, the descriptions of specifically Palestinian men as terrorists and, you know, scary people who just want to hurt and kill. And then, you know, my experience of meeting Palestinian men is like some of the most loving, kind, like open-hearted people on the planet. And it's like so mind-boggling how the reality of a people can be so different from those labels and those projections and those stereotypes that are put onto them. So yeah, I think it was, you know, my way of doing this mini rebellion of like, I am against Arab identity being dehumanized on this level. I'm against that because of what's happening to Palestinians. I'm against that because of what's happening all over the region, right? To Egyptians, to Syrians, to everybody, but also to what's happening to myself as like the way that Jews were literally just completely uprooted from this Arab context and that identity was just whitewashed and erased, that there's also a tragedy within that. So for all those reasons, which are, you know, multi-layered, but to me feel interconnected, I felt like an alignment for me.
Do you feel like Mizrahi Judaism and Arab Judaism, like these are synonyms, or is there a different context or framing of them? Are these the same thing, or how do you see them fitting into that context?
Yeah, it's a question I get a lot. I mean, so I would say, obviously, you're asking me, so I'm going to speak from my experience and my understanding. There's a lot of other people that I respect who have differing views around this, which I also understand. And maybe part of it is because I hold identity very lightly. So I don't fully have strong feelings about what the name is. I use a name Mizrahi and I use Arab Jew. You know, Mizrahi for me is helpful for a couple of reasons. One, because not all kind of people who are under the category of Mizrahim are Arab Jews. You know, partially like my Kurdish side of the family would never identify as Arab, or, you know, Amazigh people or Persians or whoever, right? There's people who are not included in this Arab identity that sometimes actually when I'm speaking, I want to include them. Yeah. And then there's a lot to unpack there about, you know, Arab identity within kind of the context of the region, not just in relationship to Israel-Palestine. But then there's also, for me, it's like, even though Mizrahi was originated as kind of this colonial racist word to lump us all in together, to me, it still feels politically relevant because the colonization is still present. So in some ways, to kind of reject that feels to reject also the necessity of the Mizrahi kind of community or collective organizing together around our liberation and Palestinian liberation and, you know, collective liberation and all of that. It kind of loses its power. You know, if all of a sudden I'm just Jerusalemite or from Aleppo or whatever it is, I get really particular into my lineage, I lose an organizing power that's there. So yeah, but then of course, Arab Jewish is more helpful, especially when I'm interfacing with an international audience, because for a lot of, especially non-Jews, when I say the word Mizrahi, they're like, I don't know what that is, right? And you need to explain all the things. And when you say Arab Jew, even though for a lot of people, it's a bit shocking at first, because they're like, oh, I thought Arab Muslim, Arab Christian. But then they're like, yeah, of course, if Arab Christians, Arab Muslims, then of course, Arab Jews isn't. So it takes a moment to think, but it's actually quite powerful because it's only a moment as opposed to like 10 years that sometimes takes for other people, right? So I enjoy it for that potent way of kind of dispelling some of the segregation and separation that has happened around Arabness and Jewishness. So, you know, I use them both because I think they both have their value in different contexts. I do understand, you know, certain people reject the term Mizrahi as kind of a colonial one. And I do understand that, and sometimes in myself also feel it. But overall, I don't feel like a strong need to do that because I still find it a helpful term.
A lot of what you just said really reminded me of a paper I read a while ago by Ella Shohat called Sephardim in Israel, Zionism from the Standpoint of Its Jewish Victims. And that paper, of course, is focused on Sephardim, but also kind of does a weird thing of conflating Sephardim and Mizrahim in a way that I think is a little antiquated. It was from the 80s. So I don't know how the historiography shapes that. But it just makes me think about the sort of internal diversity within the broad label of Mizrahim, which of course is even broader than just Arab Jews, which they kind of, again, conflate in a way that's not super nuanced. When you approach this sort of cultural inheritance, what about it? You used the word self-orientalizing earlier. Like, what about it is... can we go in that direction of self-orientalizing? And how would you relate that to like the nuances of, we've brought up the term de-assimilation before. And like, how would you navigate between these things, especially when, of course, these are all labels. It's a little bit of just a semantic discussion. But how would you go about comparing these two ideas of self-orientalizing versus de-assimilating?
Yeah, that's a great question. So I think de-assimilating is in some ways just reclaiming your ways of being back, right? Like whether it's the type of food you eat, your ways of speaking, like your rituals, all of these things, you're integrating them into a lifestyle and into just like who you are, right? It's kind of shedding all of those layers. Self-orientalizing feels like when there's particular parts of the identity that feel particularly exotic, that are highlighted and are highlighted in like a public way to be seen in a certain way, if that makes sense. So like an example, you know, that happens sometimes, let's say in the Jewish space, you know, the overall liturgy or prayer service might be fully Ashkenazi, but then they want to diversify. So they'll kind of bring up a Sephardi or Mizrahi person and they'll say like, lead us in a song, right? Like, there's something about that that can feel self-orientalizing because it's still on the side. It's not really integrated into the whole culture. And it's kind of a spectacle. And the person mm-hmm. who's also kind of performing, it also feels like a bit being watched. And then you know, sometimes you can kind of take that on even further and like really go into it even like kind of more deeply, where it's like you're purposefully pronunciating in like a deeper way the guttural sounds and all these things, which is fine because that's part of the culture, but there's something about kind of like doing it for a performance as opposed to doing it as a lifestyle in your culture. And I think there's a different energy signature to it. And it's a complicated question because I think for a lot of us, yeah, we're dealing with massive cultural erasure. So even in that example, we're like, okay, sing us a piyut or sing us a song from your lineage, right? Like, a lot of us might not necessarily know those songs. So then it's like the learning and the retraining. And then when you look, right. So it's a complex and very gentle thing. But I do often find, you know, not just in the Jewish kind of Arab Jewish world, but in the broader Arab world in general, especially in the West, where there's kind of like these ways of like this particular music and you have to have your like hummus with your za'atar. And then it becomes like the items of the culture become almost like there's an obsession with them in a way that feels quite flattening. And not in a way that's just like, oh, respecting that that's just like a lifestyle or a culture that's alive, you know?
Yeah, I think that sort of cultural fetishization is definitely extremely problematic. I mean, the self-orientalizing perspective, because often in the wider Jewish community, especially in the United States, we're like probably not quite 90% of American Jews are Ashkenazim. So it definitely like contributes to a broader culture of orientalizing certain parts of the Jewish community, which I think then ultimately serves to broadly orientalize the Jewish community within the wider American society or European or wherever Jews might be, which is a very dangerous game to play. I mean, you look at the history of anti-Semitism, it's a lot of it has been about like this racialization of Jews as the other. And ultimately this serves a very dangerous role in potentially perpetuating that into a modern era. And I'd say in a real way, Zionism actually deepens and reinforces that by saying your homeland is there rather than your homeland is here. And I think when we talk about the sort of fetishization and the risks of that, but also potentially it's a little bit more complicated than that. For example, there's someone that we're going to bring on at some point in the not so distant future, an Arab Jewish organizer in Kuwait from the Avraham Society. I believe you might have spoken with him. And I know that he has a little bit of a different perception of what it means to be an Arab Jew, which I'd say is more of like a pure Arab Jewishness. And he describes as Arab Bundism, which is quite an interesting concept. And what you're describing, as I'd say, is much more internally multicultural. I was wondering if you could go a little bit into that sort of nuance and like what kind of Arab Judaism you sort of advocate for.
A couple of things. I think that one thing is just in general about humanity is, especially when we deal with different ruptures or crises, there's kind of no going back to what was. There's processing the rupture and transforming the reality and kind of birthing a new one. And I think with Arab Jewishness, you know, one of the heartbreaks that I certainly felt for a really long time is around like not being able to go back. Like, right, there's a certain reality that we can never access again. And even if we try to recreate it, it's actually not possible.
Yeah, I actually, just to add, like, I think that's true for a lot of Ashkenazim as we kind of understand and start uncovering Yiddishkeit in the sort of Ashkenormative way.
Yeah, and I think any peoples who've experienced genocide and, you know, colonial, like, that's part of the pain and the heartbreak of it, is that certain things were actually quite erased. And certainly Palestinians also, right? There are certain things that are just gone, and there's really deep pain there. So, you know, and this is where Edward Said is just brilliant and everything he wrote, but this is one of the things that he would talk a lot about exile and rupture and all of these things where it's just like, yeah, it's actually not possible to go to a world pre-48. So if that is the reality that we're in, then what else? Then what else can happen? And I think that's how I think also about Arab Jewishness, where it's like, okay, I need to kind of let go of like that nostalgia that I have around, you know, imagining kind of what it was in Aleppo or what it was in Baghdad or all of these things, even though perhaps that's kind of vital pieces that might inform, but also to really confront. And I think this is where we can sometimes get lost, because the present moment can feel so intense that it's like, how do we process it? But we have to confront it, right? We have to look at it with like full understanding what's happening now, in order to really see the larger picture of like how we've gotten here and where we're going and all those things. And this is kind of part of why I said when, you know, hosting Shabbat, of why it feels essential for Palestinians to be part of that. It's, for me personally, I find that Palestinians are like essential to my Judaism, right? There's like, I can't actually be Jewish without being in relationship to Palestinians, because for however it was configured, we are in a time where Palestinian identity and Jewish identity are just interlocked in a certain way. So for me to try to kind of create like a certain level of Arab Jewishness outside of that feels like, I don't even know why I would do that. But to go through that portal of like what is happening to Palestinians through Jewish identity, you know, all the complexities of that, and to rework that through kind of the history that I come from, that feels like essential work. So it's not necessarily going to look like what it looked before. It's actually going to look probably completely different. And I don't even know what it's going to look like. But it's, for me, that kind of journey of putting it out there into like, okay, this is the type of lineage I come from. I'm sure also, you know, I don't want to also romanticize the Arab Jewish lineage, because it wasn't just all beauty and glory all the time, right? There was also difficulty in that identity as well. But it's like, okay, this is the portal of my identity that I come from. And how can I almost offer that as a service offering, you know? And it's something that I tangibly experience, you know, especially when I'm in spaces that are a mixture of like Palestinian or Jews. And when it's Palestinians and Ashkenazi Jews, which a lot of these joint spaces tend to be quite Ashkenazi Jewish heavy, there actually feels like there is a missing piece there, which is the Arab Jewish. And I feel like when I'm there present in those spaces, there's something that is able to kind of shift, whether it's kind of like having a more cultural connection to Palestinians that's like, oh, wait, you make this food, you listen to this. There's something in them that I feel like can relax a little bit more. And then there's something in sometimes Ashkenazi Jews that can relax that I'm like, oh, I'm Jewish, you know, so I can, you know, it sounds trite. We say this all the time of like Arab Jewish identity is like this bridge identity. But it's true also, you know, I think that part of our kind of karma or fate or whatever it is, you know, sometimes we can be destroyed in some ways by both communities, kind of by the Ashkenazi Jewish world and the larger Arab Muslim world, or we could be of great service and of great healing and also, yeah, just of great fusion of that. And it's a hard task. It's not something simple. But that to me is what Arab Judaism means in this moment.
Ben kind of framed the Zionism there-ness and the kind of the here-ness and this sense of contested place and belonging. But in your case, where you grew up in Jerusalem, you know, there is here and here is there. And when you moved, how did your relationship to land in the Israeli-Palestinian context, but also in the American context, how did that evolve? And how did your sense of rootedness to place develop? And did that kind of tie into your multicultural communities that you've been belonging to?
Yeah, you know, it's a funny story because when we moved to the U.S., I went to like a Jewish high school. And when I got there, you know, so much of the education was about Jerusalem as our homeland. And I remember, you know, as a teen being so confused because I was like, it's my homeland, it's not yours. And just feeling that discrepancy of like speaking about home in a way that feels quite disconnected from what land actually is or what it means to be of that place. And yeah, it's something that I felt, especially with Zionism, that's complex, right? That's like, you know, we have so many Jews all over the world, like coming to Israel because they feel like this is their home and then displacing the Palestinians through that. And then, you know, this is something that also just growing up in Jerusalem, you just witness year after year, like Jerusalem has become more and more American. And there's something kind of like painful there of like witnessing that. But I think like, yeah, I always felt very deeply connected to the city of Jerusalem. Like, it's not even that whole land. It's just specifically the city of Jerusalem. You know, because even when I go up north to like Haifa or I don't know, like it almost feels like I'm in a totally different space, you know? And I think that this is also how we used to be as humans. We like identified more with like the city and like the particularities of its shape than like a whole country, nation state. And yeah, I think there's something quite beautiful about that. And I think also in, you know, even when meeting like other Palestinians, like meeting Palestinians from Jerusalem is different than meeting Palestinians from Jaffa for me. There's a deeper connections to people who are from Jerusalem, just somatically and energetically. And I think over the years I've been interested in like asking this question of like, what does it look like to tend to the city that you're from? Whether, you know, doesn't necessarily have to be in the material, though it also could, but also just like energetically, like what does that relationship look like? The U.S. feels so tricky because, you know, I never felt like this is my land in any way. And there's a lot of displacement here as well. And I think that as we're kind of reckoning with these global questions of displacement and colonization and immigration and all of that, you know, like kind of bringing that spiritual frame to those very necessary critical political questions is like, what does it mean to have a home, right? And I think part of the project of Zionism and the ways that it really deeply misled Jewish people is that it said, like, if you have this plot of land, you will be healed, right? Just return to this land and game over. Like, we're fine, you know? And to me, that's such a shallow way of understanding both home and also understanding the self, the Jews, humans, right? Because just returning to a land that, sure, maybe you were from and then got displaced, but just returning to that land is not the complete story, right? There's a lot of stuff happening psychologically and spiritually that is vital to process and work through in that kind of liberation. And if we don't do that work, I think we're seeing what happens, right? Okay, Jews return back to this land, but what's the cost of that? You know, and of course, you could look at the ongoing genocide and Nakba that's happening to Palestinians, and that is, you know, the main cost. And you could also look at like what has become of Jewish people in Israel, you know, the type of people that that country produces that's highly militarized, you know, and it's like, was this really our prayer? Like, is this really what we've been yearning for? So there's something there that needs to be examined around what do we think home is, right? Because it cannot just be this physical land. It has to actually integrate these deeper dimensions of understanding ourselves as humans.
What you just said is absolutely true. I mean, whose dream is this? Frankly, if we look really concretely, it was like Vladimir Jabotinsky, the revisionist Zionists, which were directly inspired by fascist movements in 1920s and 30s Europe. And this was their vision of a home that is a national home, emphasis on the national, because really it is a nation state that they understand as home, which is why I actually love the idea of self-determination, but I hate the way that it's used to mean national domination over a specific territory. And especially when I really like the way you say, like, all, like, Haifa is not my home, Jerusalem is your home. And I think there's something really deeply human about connecting to a space in like such a personal way and such a local way, emphasizing that like the direct place you grow up, that's really your homeland. It's very much what brought me to the idea of diasporism, that like whether I go to my great-grandparents' homeland, which would have been like Poland or Belarus or Ukraine or these lands, they're not necessarily my homeland. My homeland is, I mean, frankly, it's a big part of why I moved back to Santa Cruz. This is a place where I really feel at home. I really have come to love the redwood trees and all the wonderful natural neighbors we have here. It did make me think about when you said that Jerusalem was like your home. It did make me think about the course of Israeli-Palestinian history of the region over the last 100 years. I mean, you look at the partition plan of 1947, Jerusalem was actually going to be like an international zone. It was going to be a place that was not a Jewish state or a Palestinian state. It was, I don't remember the word they used for it, but it was something else. It was a separate entity that would have international stewardship, which is to say that, like, I mean, it's the holiest place within Judaism. It's one of the holiest places in Christianity. It's one of the holiest places in Islam. So there's a lot of reasons why it would be seen as like an international stewardship. But I mean, of course, that never actually came to fruition. And instead, we've had the creation and the imposition of competing nationalist identities, whether it be Zionism and Jewish nationalism or Arab nationalism or later Palestinian nationalism. And I was kind of wondering, if, correct me if I'm wrong, I believe you've identified as a Palestinian Jew as well as an Arab Jew. And I was wondering if you could say a little bit about how your own personal family and community history and present has been informed or shaped by the last century or so of politics and history across the region.
So what you said about Jerusalem as this international city, one of the things that it might have shifted since like the Trump presidency, I'm not sure, but on American passport, Jerusalem is one of the only places where if you're born in Jerusalem, you can choose what it says. Like you could say Jerusalem, Israel, it could say Jerusalem, Palestine, or it could just say Jerusalem. So on my passport, it actually just says Jerusalem, which I think is quite fascinating. So just to be able to be like, I'm just from the city. That's, you know, like the legalities of that might have shifted. In terms of like the Palestinian Jewish identity, you know, it's so fascinating because it's such a controversial one. And so many people have a lot to say about that. And even within myself, you know, I've struggled around that terminology. My grandmother identified as such. She grew up, you know, my grandparents were born in the 1930s in the old city of Jerusalem. And, you know, she had Palestinian friends till the day she died. And that was just normal and natural for her. But, you know, I think part of the tragedy of this identity is that we did get separated from other Palestinians, you know, and we got separated through this project that, you know, created this apartheid system that's based off of Jewish supremacy. It's this awkwardness of like, wait, we were part of this place. We were part of this region. We were in relationship with the people of this land, Palestinians. And now, because of our Jewishness, we're now this like part of this larger system of domination. And it's really uncomfortable. And it's hard to know, you know, of course, there's the solidarity work to do. But other than, you know, until the kind of apartheid system is dismantled, it's hard to kind of exist in that space where you're like, I'm from here, but I'm also have this power that I don't actually want, this kind of like power of domination because of my Jewishness and because of the way that the system is set up. I think Yuval Ivry, who's another Arab Jewish academic, wrote a whole thing about when does a native become a settler, you know? So like what happens when, right, the structures of governance shift. So that's all to say is that, you know, with Palestinian Jewish identity over the years, the way that I've made sense of it is that politically, I'm not that, you know, I'm not Palestinian because I do not live under occupation and I don't have to suffer in those ways that Palestinians suffer under occupation and apartheid and all of this. But on the other hand, I am culturally, right? And in terms of like shared lineage, shared food, shared ways of being, shared, all of those things. So it's kind of like this gap. And yeah, I think the kind of discomfort there is part of what motivates me into the political work of like, I don't actually feel safe and comfortable in my identity so long as the status quo continues in this way.
I think you really highlight some of the nuance that is often overlooked when it comes to the sense of home or belonging, because it's not inherently political. You know, like we live under nation states, but that's secondary to the fact that we're living in a community, we're living in a city, or we're living on the land. And I feel like I'm an ecologist and I approach these things through kind of a more biological lens of like, where does our food come from? Where does our water come from? Who's lived here before and why am I here? And in that sense, like identity being relational, but then political, and this political system coming secondary can transform our self-image, can transform how we see the world. And there's just so much harm that has come out of the nationalisms of the 20th century. I want to kind of steer us towards concluding, but thinking a little bit more about identity. Zionism as a political movement has continually pitted Arabs against Jews and Jews against Arabs and framed this as a mutually exclusive concept, as a mutually exclusive conflict. And then there's other groups that are, you know, doing this justice work like B'Tselem or the Center for Jewish Nonviolence that are bringing Arabs and Jews, largely Ashkenazi Jews, as you have alluded to, but bringing these people together in solidarity. But they've never really been centering Arab Jews or Jewish Arabs or Palestinian Jews, Mizrahi Jews. What's missing from these framings of identity? What do you think is necessary to create a more widespread sense of mutual belonging between Jews in Palestine and Arabs in Palestine, between all the people living in Israel-Palestine?
You know, it's funny because I recently led a retreat for Arab Jews alongside Professor Avi Shlaim in the UK, which was really a beautiful retreat. But there was a couple of people who applied to that thinking that it was a retreat bringing Arabs and Jews together. And I had to clarify, I'm like, no, this is for people who are Arab Jewish and like in one identity. So it is interesting because a lot of times when you see those two words, Arab Jews or Arab Jewish, like you just assume that, oh, it's two different people that are coming together in a coexistence camp. And what does that look like when you're just talking about one person, actually? Which is to say, to answer your question, you know, I think that part of what's missing when Arab Jews are not included in the space is a whole orientation and a whole different way of thinking and relating. You know, a lot of the time, the way that I look at what's happening in Israel-Palestine, you know, from a trauma lens, is that it's, you know, Ashkenazi Jewish trauma intersecting with Palestinian Arab trauma, right? And just like on a somatic trauma level, they function really, really differently. That is part of where the traumas are just like bound up together. But for Arab Jews, I think we can taste the traumas of both, like we oscillate, not in the full depth of either, right? And one of the things that I say a lot is that part of being in the identity that I am, you know, it's about also constantly growing up with stories of the Holocaust and the Nakba, and those stories being so central to my reality, but neither of those stories are mine, you know? So it's like this awkward place of like constantly being in relationship to these two horrifying things that have happened and those things impacting me, but neither of them are my story, you know? So it's like, yeah, I think that there's actually something there that's quite powerful to be able to both witness these things, but to also come and say, actually, I have a completely different narrative and different story that doesn't even fit in to those things, but it's kind of juxtaposed like in between them a bit. And it's kind of like that crack that once it kind of gets in, it starts to shatter the whole configuration. And I'll also say part of what's missing a lot in the larger international discourse is that the majority of the Israeli population is Mizrahi, is of Arab Jewish background, is of Middle Eastern background. And I always find it so fascinating how so much of international political discourse is so focused on Israel-Palestine and so little attention is given to anything that is Arab Jewish, Mizrahi. And it almost doesn't make sense because you're like, okay, there's so much attention on this, but you're kind of missing a large population that's living there. And I think there's a reason why. So yeah, I don't know if it fully answers your question. Your question could be, you know, unpacked for so, so long. And still it's something that I'm also learning because sometimes, you know, even for me, I'm just like, you know, sometimes I'm in these spaces of Jewish, Palestinian, and it's not so much Arab Jews. And then I'm like, okay, well, what am I doing here? I should just step out, you know? But then sometimes it's like, actually, no, there's something to shift here that can create something different.
Yeah. We all have our stories and there's so much nuance and learning, you know, in this world dominated by nation states, it's really hard to think of a way of identifying yourself that isn't based on a racial caste system or a national identity.
Yeah, one thing I wanted to say, I mean, so you just alluded to like, you have these different stories, yet neither of them are yours, yet you have your own story. And I was wondering if that was a place, if we could make space for you to kind of tell what that story is, because I mean, as you literally just said, Mizrahi Jews, like Arab and broader, like quote unquote, Eastern Jews, those big broad categories make up a majority of quote unquote, Israeli citizens. Mm-hmm. And like, if you do wish to transform Israeli-Palestinian society, you need to recognize this. I mean, I've talked to Zionists who literally their number one defense of Israel and the need for Israel ends up being the response to Zionism in the Arab world, which was to say expulsion of Jews from the Arab world. And therefore, Arab Jews become a raison d'etre, like a reason for being, the reason for existence for the state of Israel, when what you're saying demonstrates like maybe that's all nonsense. I mean, actually, the person that hosted the conference that you helped lead, that you organized, I was at a conference that he hosted as well, which was organized by the Diaspora Alliance last July 2023. And him and I did like this little exercise of like imagining a campaign we could push for. And I was just like, I don't have anything in particular. I want to hear what you have. And he's also like a Mizrahi Jew. And he argued that one of the big things we should be pushing for was like a campaign to pressure the Iraqi state to dissolve their, what was it called? It was like a citizenship law in 1950 that basically has been used to bar Jews from having the right of return to Iraq. And there are many tens of thousands of Jews that were expelled and live in Israel today that don't have a right of return. So it sort of raises the question of a broader diasporist politic for the region. But I was kind of wondering if you could go into a little bit of the narrative that you center in your politics, the path you'd like to see your work leading towards, and the sort of future you believe might be possible through these cracks.
Yeah, wow, a lot to say there. Yeah, I think part of like the fight for Palestinian liberation, which I think if you pay attention to what's happening in the Arab world, feels pretty clear, right? When other Arabs are supporting Palestinians, they're not just supporting Palestinians for, like, they also see themselves in that struggle. And I think that there's a lot of truth there where it's like shifting the dynamic of what's happening in Israel-Palestine is not just about that land. It's about that whole region, actually. And, you know, for me also, it's spiritually about the whole world, like, because I do think that it's a global focus point. So what's possible there actually directly translates to what's possible in other spaces as well. I do feel that part of dismantling that notion that Jews can only be safe through like this nation state that exerts domination and force over another people. The other narrative is about Jewish belonging to the wider human web. And I think that part of, for me, of like fighting against Zionism is also creating a world of Jewish safety in different contexts. And yeah, like my dream is for Jews to be able to like live in Baghdad again. And, you know, and I mean, in Egypt, there's a lot of stuff happening now. Morocco, of course, Tunisia also. Like, I have different friends who've also moved to these places in desire of creating Jewish community there again. And, you know, I think one of the things that's also so interesting about it is so much of Zionism is about using the Bible and Torah to like justify certain things. But if we were to like follow that all the way, like, of course, Iraq, of course, Syria, of course, like all these places are, you know, steeped in Jewish lineage. And, you know, I have so many Arab and Palestinian friends who like actively support that vision of like Jewish return to these spaces. You know, I had a really beautiful Syrian Muslim woman reach out to me recently because she was going back to Syria and she found out about this home that used to be a Syrian Jewish home. And they found like some stuff that was left over from that family. And she was like, I want to contact you about finding the family so I can return the stuff. And, you know, so like there's things like that that are happening. Now, of course, it's always the difference around happening in terms of people and community versus governmental structures and systems. And that's part of what we're working through is like, how do we kind of create a different architecture, which I don't have all the answers to, but I do know that the more we build in the community peoplehood space, the more transformation is possible on that level as well. So yeah, I mean, I think that kind of model of open borders, of multiculturalism, of multi-religiosity, you know, that for me, the ideal is that, you know, it begins with Jerusalem, but it kind of emanates to the whole region and then to the whole world is like this model, which is really a model of how do we honor other people who have different paths than us, who are have, you know, a different spiritual orientation, who have a different tradition, who looks different, you know, it really is just that in the most simple core way.
It's a really beautiful vision. It reminds me a little bit of the Kurdish autonomist movement based in Rojava, which, for those who don't know, is a confederalist movement, which is trying to allow communities to self-determine beyond a nation state system where communities are directly interfacing with one another. And I guess a few years ago, I was thinking, like, what if that could be expanded to a whole regional thing as a solution to this, you know, decades long conflict? And, you know, it feels a little bit like a pipe dream because there are so many powerful nation states and militaries, but at the same time, there is, you know, just a hope on the horizon. You have Kurdish ancestry. Has that movement inspired you at all?
Yeah, definitely. And, you know, it's something that was also kind of another level of shame because kind of within the Mizrahi racial dynamics, there's also, you know, the hierarchy around usually Iraqis are on top and then, you know, whatever, we have our whole other system, but Kurdish people tend to be on the bottom. And yeah, I think it was only actually after I moved to Los Angeles and I met a lot of Kurdish activists and Kurdish friends who were super inspiring, who I could like see myself through, who also did a lot of educational work with me. Yeah, like all of a sudden I was like, wow, this is a really, really cool lineage to be from. I don't feel like I'm as rooted in it as I am in my other kind of aspects of myself, though it is something that I want to continue and deepen and definitely also be a stronger ally to the Kurdish people, because I often feel that, yeah, their struggle is just not seen and not understood, mm-hmm. you know, in the international world, but even in the regional dynamics.
Yeah, I've been inspired by that movement just because they integrated like a radical ecological politics and a feminist politics and a human, deeply human politics. You know, it kind of reminds me just of love thy neighbor as yourself, or the flip side, which Rabbi Hillel says, of that which is hateful unto you, do not do unto your neighbor. And that's the whole of the Torah, as a few people, including Hillel, has said. The rest is just commentary. To bring about that better world, I feel like we need to take inspiration from others, from, you know, as many different movements as we can. And I'm so inspired by your work. Do you want to plug your podcast or your other work that you have doing? Where can other people find you?
Yeah, sure. Gosh, I have so many different places you can go. I have my personal website if anyone wants to contact me. It's just hadarcohen.me. I also have my spiritual school, which is called Malchut, and the website is malchut.one, which is, there's a lot of different offerings. There's a Jewish mystical school with a lot of classes. If you want to learn more about Judaism, there's also God Fellowship, which is like direct experience of God and how to integrate relationship with God into a daily lifestyle. So there's a lot of spiritual teachings there. I also have a Substack, which I think is just hadarcohen.substack.com. That's kind of serves as also my newsletter. So different events or writings or workshops that I'm leading are all on there. I have a Patreon as well if you want to support. I think it's just patreon.com/hadarcohen32. And then my Instagram is just hadarcohen32 as well. So there's a long list of places to find me. I also have my podcast, which is called Hadar's Web, which is conversations about spirituality and justice and healing and art.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely wonderful. And we'll put all of that in the description just so everyone can easily find your stuff. And frankly, it's been an absolute pleasure to have you to talk about these topics as not a person that I think I more turn to learn about this stuff. I'm really inspired by a lot of the work you do, and I'm really hoping that we can stay in conversation and continue to work for the better world that we're hoping to build together, because it's really going to take all of us, and it's so important to have all the different perspectives that we can have, because there's so much diversity within the Jewish tradition, especially the Jewish left tradition, that it's really going to take all of us to be in dialogue with each other so that we can come to the conclusions and find the solutions when there's so many problems that we face all at once.
Amen. Yes. Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciated your very thoughtful questions and having the space to just share a little bit about myself and my perspective. So thank you.
Thank you so much, Hadar. This is really lovely.